When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Into the Dark podcast. I am your host, Peyton Moreland, and I am so, so happy that you are here listening. I hope everyone who is listening or watching is having an amazing day. Really quick, if you're watching on YouTube, please stop right now and give this video a thumbs up, leave a comment. And if you are listening on podcasts and can leave a review, it helps me out so much, and I am forever grateful. As you know, on this show, we love to dive into everything dark, spooky, even murder, true crime. But before we do that, we always start with my 10 seconds, which is just a little icebreaker, if you will, before we get into the gritty stuff. So this week, I just wanted to give you guys an update. I have been doing good. I read all of your responses to my last 10 seconds where I talked about having a panic attack on stage at our live show. And just, I know so many of us are struggling. And even if it's not necessarily with panic, so many of you reached out. All of the comments were so kind. And I literally have gone back and reread every single YouTube comment, all the comments, all the DMs we got. And I just want to say thank you so much for always supporting me and for always being there. And I hope you know that I feel the same for you guys. And I hope that we can all just really find joy in this life. That being said, lately I have been on a swinging kick, and like, I mean, swinging at a playground, like a park, like on a swing set. I've always loved swinging. But lately when I take my walks every single day outside, I just will stop at a park, a local park, and swing. And it's just gotten, okay, a little out of hand. I'm not gonna lie. I was on it for an hour the other day, but it feels so good. And it just feels playful. And, I just put my music in and I don't have to talk, and it feels so nice. So I hope you guys can all find something like that this week. And yeah, that's my update on my 10 seconds. And with that being said, let's start the episode. Okay, so there is a question that I think everyone has asked themselves at one point or another. And it's, in an extreme situation when it's kill or be killed, what would you do? Could you take someone else's life to save yourself? What if it was saving a friend, maybe a stranger, a family member? Now, thankfully for most of us, that question is purely hypothetical. We never need to learn firsthand what our own limits are. But when war came to Haarlem, a suburb just outside of Amsterdam, three teenage girls learned just how much violence they were capable of. See, Haarlem, the suburb outside of Amsterdam, was home to two sisters, one named Truce and another named Freddy, last name Overstegen. Now, their parents divorced when they were 10 and 8 years old, respectively, and obviously this is back in 1933. And then afterward, their father wasn't really a part of their lives at all. He moved out of town, married someone new, and went on to have more kids. So basically, he settled down with an entire different family. And from that point on, Truce and Freddy were raised by a single mother who was very politically active. Their mom was a part of the local Communist Party, and she believed very strongly in equality for all people, regardless of their race, gender, or religion. Now, this set her apart from a lot of people in Europe at the time. See, the same year that the Oversteigens divorced, Adolf Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany. Now, we all know how terrible life was for Jewish people living under Hitler's rule. But even in countries like the Netherlands, where the Oversteigens lived, there were rules that targeted and discriminated against Jewish people once this happened. This didn't stop refugees from fleeing to places like Holland, though. As bad as life could be for them in the Dutch community, it was still safer than staying in a Nazi-run country. So Truus and Freddie's family personally hosted a number of Jewish refugees, even though it was illegal to do this at the time. They'd let the strangers sleep in their mother's bed while she spent each night cuddled up against Truus. And one time the police actually caught the women with Jewish fugitives in their home, but luckily the authorities decided to look the other way. But the discovery could have gone a lot worse. I mean, Truus and Freddie's mother was risking an arrest. Even in the face of all this danger, though, she taught the young girls the importance of doing what was right, even when they might get in trouble for it. And this also meant Truus and Freddie knew how to keep a secret from a young age, because obviously they never told anyone about the Jewish families that were in their home. And when they learned the identities of other people who were harboring refugees, they kept that information secret too. This ability to stay quiet became especially crucial in mid-May 1940, when Nazi Germany invaded the Netherlands. Fighting only lasted for 5 days before the Dutch government surrendered. So by this point, Truus was 16 years old and Freddie was 14. But they remembered the lessons their mother had taught them. They opposed the Nazis and they decided to stand up to them, even if there was a cost to it. The girls and their mother ran an illegal printing press out of their home, and they published flyers and pamphlets all about how terrible the Nazi regime was and the importance of resisting them. And they'd hand these out or even cover up Nazi propaganda posters with their own anti-Nazi flyers. So Truus also got very good at graffiti at this point, so when they didn't have any flyers handy, she'd just draw symbols and slogans on the walls that made it clear how she felt about Hitler. Now again, this was risky for all three women, Truus, Freddie, and their mother. Like I said, they could have been arrested or even killed for openly opposing the new regime. But Truus and Freddie had something working in their favor, and that was their youth. They just didn't look like they posed a threat to the invading Nazis. Especially Freddie, who was only 14. She wore her hair in braids that made her look even younger, maybe like she wasn't even a teenager yet. So even when soldiers spotted her loitering on the street, maybe late at night, when she didn't have a good reason to be there, they mostly didn't give her a second look. But someone else did notice what Truus and Freddie were up to, and it was a recruiter with the Dutch Resistance. Now, the Resistance was a huge movement in the Netherlands during World War II. Roughly one out of every 20 people was part of it. Most of them distributed anti-Nazi reading material or helped bring refugees to safety, the same kinds of things that Truus and Freddie were already doing. But apparently, someone within the Resistance thought that the sisters were capable of more once they found out about them. So one night in 1941, a stranger showed up at their front door and asked if he could come in. Now, the girl's mother knew who he was, and she gave him permission to talk to her daughters, and she actually left the room. She understood the importance of privacy and secrecy in these sorts of situations. So once they were alone, the man said he knew what the Oversteigen women had been up to, and he was impressed with what they'd accomplished. Even more importantly, the Resistance needed people who could do their work under the radar without drawing suspicion. And so it was the fact that Truus and Freddie were so young and had basically up until this point gone unnoticed by the Nazis that was really appealing to him. He believed that they could take on more important missions that were too dangerous for older, more established members. But the girls obviously would be dealing with a lot of risk. So the older sister, Truce, was immediately nervous. She wasn't sure if the man was who he said he was or if he was trying to set a trap, but Freddie was a bit more impulsive and she said she was all in. She even said on the spot that she'd be willing to kill Nazis so long as someone could point her in the right direction. So it sounds like at this point, Freddie's enthusiasm helped persuade Truce and both of the girls decided to join. Now, obviously, the girls knew the risk they were taking, but it's safe to say that their biggest fear was about to become true. Because a little while later, they would go on to meet with their recruiter again. And this time, they weren't going to meet him at their house, and their mom had not come with them. So it was just the two girls meeting him somewhere. And unfortunately, the man pulled a gun on the two girls and announced that he was actually a member of the German secret police. He had lied to them. This was literally worst case scenario. This was what they were afraid of. His story about working with the Dutch resistance had all been a front, and he'd tricked them into committing treason. Now, this man told Truce and Freddy that the only way to save themselves from prison was to cooperate fully. Then he asked them to tell him where various Jewish refugees were hiding and he'd let them go. Now, the girls did know the information he was looking for. They could have easily given up those fugitives to protect themselves, but they didn't. Truce and Freddy had spent their entire lives with the understanding that you don't betray your comrades, even if your life is at stake. So instead of answering the man's questions, the two girls decided to attack him. Freddie pulled off her shoes and used them like weapons. She hit the man with them. Truce charged him. And even though the girls weren't trained fighters, it was two versus one. Maybe the man had underestimated the sisters because they were so small and young, but before long, they had him on the ground. Freddie pinned him down, and then one of the girls got her hands on his gun and pointed it at him. And that's when the man revealed, okay, I'm not actually a German police officer. His original story was true. He actually was a part of the resistance and he'd wanted to test the girls' loyalty to see if they could keep a secret when their lives were on the line. Now, as you're listening to this, you're probably like, that's effed up. Like, what just happened? These are young girls. There's no parent present. This is crazy. But at the same time, you have to understand the political climate they were in and that you couldn't just like freely openly trust people either. So I've got to imagine that Truce and Freddy probably had a hard time trusting him after this point, even though they understood. But to prove he was honest, the man showed them that the gun wasn't even loaded, that they'd never been in danger. But once they started doing real resistance work, they would be. So Truce and Freddy had proven that they were willing to take on the risk, at least kind of. They still didn't know exactly what kind of work they'd be doing with the resistance. The man had been pretty vague about it. He talked about dangerous missions, but he hadn't shared many details about what they involved. So the girls forgive him for this little test and they decide to move on. And it was only after Truce and Freddy enlisted that they learned they needed to take shooting lessons to become familiar with guns. And they would do marching drills with other recruits deep in the woods. It was literally like they were forming an army. Now, before long, they started getting real missions. And since they were young and new to the resistance, they were usually paired with other more experienced freedom fighters. But that doesn't mean their early tasks were low stakes or simple. Truce and Freddy sabotaged railroad tracks and bridges. They had to blow up at least one freight train. And later missions included planting bombs in a power plant and in a movie theater that screened pro-Nazi propaganda films. I'm including this so you understand that this was very intense work. They also accepted assignments to transport illegal goods all over the city. Sometimes it was propaganda pamphlets and newspapers, kind of like what they were used to. But on other occasions, the sisters would carry weapons to different resistance members. Some days they'd hang out around town, smiling and acting sweet and approachable. They'd strike up conversations with Nazi officials or find an excuse to sit close enough to them to overhear what they were saying to each other. Amazingly, Freddy and Truce figured out where many troops were stationed, and they'd pass that information along, and it made it all the way to the British Army, who needed the intel for their military strategy. So foreign governments were literally planning attacks around what Truce and Freddie managed to learn in their small town. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes something will bug me and I literally will sit and stew about it forever, making a mountain of something totally mundane, and it will nag at me until I'm able to get it off my chest. We all carry around different stressors, big and small, but when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. The thing I love about therapy is it isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's helpful for literally anyone. Therapy has helped me so much during times when I felt like I was even doing okay. I have a better perspective on things in my life. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. So just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dark today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. help.com/dark. True crime fans, do you have a knack for solving mysteries? Well, it's time for you to meet your new favorite game, June's Journey. Dive headfirst into the opulent and perilous world of the 1920s as June Parker, determined to unravel the enigma of her sister's murder. With each hidden clue you discover, you're not just solving puzzles. You're peeling back layers of scandalous family secrets, navigating through danger, and even stumbling into unexpected romance. Imagine every scene is a gateway to a new thrilling storyline, taking you from the parlors of New York to the sidewalks of Paris. You guys, I've been engrossed in a chapter that's challenging and utterly compelling. If you're like me, enjoying a puzzle to unwind, June's Journey hits the spot. Plus, I mean, decorating my estate is incredibly satisfying. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. So one night, the resistance leaders gave Truce and Freddie an especially dangerous assignment. They knew a high-ranking German officer was going to be at a particular bar at a specific time. The resistance wanted Truce to lure the man into the woods and for a resistance assassin to wait for him with a gun at the ready. Freddie would be the lookout. I guess the resistance leaders didn't feel like the 14-year-old was ready to actually kill anyone yet. Either way, once Truce had led the Nazi away from any witnesses or bystanders, the sharpshooter would kill him. Now, this was the first time that either girl had to participate in an assassination, and they grimly accepted their assignment. However, the officer didn't end up showing up that night. Maybe he changed his mind about going out drinking, or maybe he hit up another bar. It's not clear what he was up to, but the girls got another chance a few days later. So once again, Truce went to the bar dressed up in a nice outfit and with her hair and makeup done. And she could tell from the way the German officer looked at her that he thought she was pretty. So Truce flirted with him. It was hard because deep down she felt sick about knowing this man was going to be killed. And it probably didn't help that Truce was still only 16 and her target was an adult man. But she had her mission and she was going to see it through. She believed it was for a good cause. So Truce told the officer that she wished they could have some alone time together and mentioned that there was a wooded area nearby. The German officer picked up on what she was implying, and before long, he was following her through the forest. Now, the soldier had no idea he was walking into danger. Truce tried to coax him deeper and deeper, slipping through the thick trees. She led him as far from the bar as possible. This was so no one could hear the gun. But the officer just kept wanting to stop along the way. He was begging Truce for a kiss, and she kept resisting, all while she had this tight knot in her stomach. So finally, they make it to the right spot. Truce knew they'd made it because the gunman from the resistance walked up to them both. He pretended he was a local, and he made a big show out of supposedly catching Truce and the Nazi officer together. He ordered them to leave right away, and when Truce and the soldier turned their backs on him, a loud crack echoed through the trees, and the German officer dropped dead. The resistance soldier had shot him from behind. And as soon as the sound of the gunshot rang out, he and Truce ran away, but Freddie, the lookout, froze up. She stayed right there in the forest, next to the dead German soldier. It was only by luck that she didn't get caught before Truce came back for her. Afterward, the girls safely made it back home. They later learned that the Nazi had been stripped and buried. The resistance kept his clothes and ID, so it would be harder to identify the corpse if he was ever found. And for the record, he never was. It's still unclear to this day where this man is buried. And the resistance refused to tell the girls where to find him, too. They thought the information would be too upsetting for such young teenagers, which was pretty ironic. Apparently, Truce and Freddie were mature enough to help kill a man, but not deal with the aftermath. But as time went on, the girls got more used to the brutality of their work, and it became easier for them to kill their targets. And Truce and Freddie had learned something from the very first assassination. Their sexuality was a useful tool. So they used the same trick time after time. They would dress up, they would go out to bars, and they would flirt with Nazi officers to lure them into the woods. And then eventually they would get to a point where they could actually pull the trigger for themselves rather than relying on a resistance gunman to step in. One sister would be the bait, seducing her target, and the other would hide out in the forest waiting to fire. And their missions actually became even more effective once they teamed up with Janetti Johanna Schaft, who went by a number of nicknames, including Hani. Now, just like Truce and Freddie, Hani was a teenager from Hallam, and when the Nazis invaded in 1940, Hani was a 19-year-old law school student, and she had a lot of Jewish friends. So Hani became very upset when the new government began passing laws targeting her classmates. So when Jewish people were banned from walking in a particular park, Hani also refused to set foot in that park. It was her way of showing support for her Jewish loved ones. She attended public protests. And then the government passed a new law saying that everyone above the age of 15 had to carry an ID with them at all times, and the IDs also specified who was Jewish and who wasn't. So on May 9th, 1942, obviously things got even worse, and Jewish people were suddenly required to wear yellow stars on their clothes. And that's when Hani began breaking the law for her friends. She'd go to public spaces where a lot of people were gathered, like maybe restaurants, theaters, swimming pools. And when strangers weren't paying a close attention to their purses or wallets, she would steal their IDs, and then she'd give the documentation to Jewish people that she knew. That way, they had the option not to wear the yellow star. And if a German officer ever saw them and asked for identification, Hani's friends would have a valid ID card that they could show. And it said they weren't Jewish, and so technically they weren't breaking any laws. Now, eventually, Hani decided to get even more involved. Now, unlike Truce and Freddie, she didn't wait for a recruiter to show up and ask her to join the resistance. She figured out who was already a member and told them she wanted to be a part of the movement. So just like the sisters, Hani was immediately put to the test, but the resistance wasn't worried about her loyalty. They wanted to confirm if she had a killer instinct. So one day, a resistance member handed her a gun and pointed out a man on the street, and he told Hani to kill him. Now, Hani had never taken a life before, and this was a huge request. She hadn't even had time to mentally prepare herself for the kill, but she did what she was asked. She aimed and pulled the trigger. Obviously, nothing happened. The gun wasn't loaded, and her target wasn't a Nazi. He was a member of the resistance who'd helped set up the test. So after Hani tried to kill him, he came over and shook her hand. But the problem was, Hani was extremely shaken up. She'd just been through the emotional wringer from thinking that she was going to kill a man and then realizing that she'd been tricked. Hani began crying, told him how angry she was. But once she calmed down, she realized how important the entire setup had been. She'd proven that she was ready for a real mission. So they encouraged her to team up with Truce and Freddie since they had so much in common. They were all young and innocent looking. And the three of them were the only women in the entire Hallam resistance cell. But that didn't mean they were any weaker or softer or less committed than their male comrades. In fact, Truce, Freddie, and Hani were a deadly team when they decided to work together. They didn't only target Nazi officers, they also eliminated, or liquidated, as they put it, Dutch collaborators. The resistance knew that their friends and neighbors who helped the German occupiers were even more dangerous than Hitler's actual forces. They knew the locals had a sense of people's personal beliefs and could provide very detailed information to the Nazis. So a big part of Truce, Freddie, and Hani's work was about identifying and assassinating these people. Sometimes the girls used the same tactic I mentioned earlier. They'd lure men away from bars by flirting with them. They also became very good at firing a gun while riding a bike. It was riskier to shoot people in the middle of the public street, but the bicycle also made it easier for Truce, Freddie, and Hani to make a quick getaway afterward. Now, we don't actually know how many Nazi and Nazi sympathizers the girls assassinated over the course of World War II. Whenever anyone asked, even for years after the war was over, they refused to answer. The girls said it's rude to ask a soldier how many people they've killed in a war, and that's how they saw themselves, as soldiers. So on June 21st, 1944, Hani and a young resistance member named Jan Bonjamp accepted new orders, and it was to assassinate a dangerous police officer. They each grabbed their guns and hopped on their bikes. However, when they tried to kill the police officer, he fired back at them and he hit Jan. The two of them rode away as fast as they could, but later Jan's injuries were bad enough that he had to check into a hospital. Now, there weren't that many people in town showing up in the emergency room with unexplained gunshot wounds, so even though Jan didn't tell anyone how he'd gotten shot, it didn't take long for German authorities to put two and two together. Soon, the Nazi officials knew Jan was an assassin who was working with the resistance, and they tried to get whatever information out of him that they could, but Jan was loyal and he refused to name names. But the Nazis found a way to trick the information out of him. And it's not entirely clear how they did that. It's been said that maybe Jan had a photograph of Hani in his pocket. It might have even had her home address written on it. So perhaps when the police searched him, they found the picture of Hani, realized she was the second assassin, and knew exactly where to go to find her. Different reports say that the German police got a local nurse to engage in a bit of deception. She went to Jan privately and pretended she was a part of the resistance. Then she told him that she wanted to help the other assassin, but she just needed him to tell her the name. Either way, somehow while Jan was in the hospital, the authorities figured out who Hani was and where she lived. And the records from the time aren't great, and I'm not sure on the details. But somehow the actual leaders in the resistance realized that she'd been compromised. So once Hani realized that she'd been exposed, she had to go into hiding. So she stayed in Harlem so she could keep working with Truce and Freddie, but Hani got a new ID card with a new name on it. And on top of that, she dyed and straightened her hair. She actually naturally had vibrant red curly locks, but now she was a wanted criminal, so she used black hair dye. This disguise worked well for Hani for almost an entire year. Really, no one gave her a second look until March 21st, 1945. So that day, she was on a scouting mission, and like always, her hair was straight and dyed black. By this point, the war was close to coming to an end, and the Nazi forces were cracking down on the local populations. It was like they knew that their time was limited, and they were lashing out at the few remaining people who weren't powerful enough to stand up to them. So the police officers set up roadblocks and forced every person who passed to show their ID. And it didn't matter whether someone actually looked suspicious or if they'd been doing anything illegal, everyone had to show their identification. And when Hani went through, the police asked to see what was in her bag. Now, this was a problem because Hani had a bunch of anti-Nazi propaganda papers with her. And as soon as the officers saw them, they arrested her. Now, at this point, they had no idea that Hani was a wanted assassin or she was using a fake name. They were really only focused on the pamphlets. But as part of the check-in process at the jail, Hani had to take a shower. And as soon as the water hit her head, the black homemade dye that she had been using started to run. And that clued the Nazis in that she was probably hiding her real identity. So they forced her to scrub with shampoo until finally her original curly red hair showed through. And that's when they realized who she was. Now afterward, Hani was tortured for information, but she barely gave anything away. She only shared a few details. Specifically, Hani took credit for all the liquidations that she'd performed. She didn't say who she'd worked with or betray any members of the resistance, but she wanted the Nazis to know just how many people she'd killed. She wasn't just bragging. She actually saved lives by confessing. She knew of five other prisoners who'd been captured, and they'd been sentenced to death for assassinations that were actually her doing. So when Hani said she was the real killer, she convinced the authorities to let these prisoners live. But other than that, she didn't give them any information that they could use to hurt the resistance. Now, once the Nazis realized that Hani wasn't going to break, they sentenced her to death, and her execution day was on April 17th, about a month after her capture. 24-year-old Hani climbed into a car, and some officers drove her to a remote area outside of town to shoot her. It was definitely a lot more like a murder than a state-sanctioned execution. This might be because the Nazis had actually signed an international agreement saying they weren't going to execute any more prisoners of war. So when they decided to kill Hani, they technically broke their promise and the law. This obviously didn't stop them from going through with the killing. It just meant that they went out of their way to hide what they were doing. They even destroyed a lot of their paperwork about her arrest, the time she spent behind bars, basically erasing any evidence that she was ever in custody. There's no record of who actually killed Hani. But we know the first shot missed. It grazed her ear, but didn't seriously injure her. And she said, "Ouch, idiot, I shoot better." Those were her last words. Her killer then pointed a gun at her and fired, and this time he didn't miss.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So just 3 weeks later, the war ended. It's frustrating to think that Hani might have survived if she'd just been captured a week or two later, or if her jailers had waited a little longer to execute her, or even if they'd kept their promise not to kill any prisoners. So many things could have played out just a little differently, and she would have lived. But her partners, Truce and Freddie, did survive the war. Afterward, they spent years dealing with the psychological toll of what they'd been through and what they'd done. It wasn't just because of the people they'd killed, but also because of the crimes that they'd witnessed. For years, Truce was haunted by the memories of a particular massacre that played out right before her eyes. One day while she was biking down the street, she saw some Nazi officials grabbing pedestrians at random and just executing them against the wall. These people hadn't done anything wrong. The officers were just cruelly killing people because they could. In addition to learning how to live with the pain, the girls also broke their silence. Now that they didn't have to hide what they'd done from the Nazis, they wanted the world to know all about the great things that the Dutch resistance had accomplished. So Truce wrote a book on her experiences, and both sisters gave many interviews. One thing stood in the way of them becoming celebrated as heroes, though, and that was the sisters' communist beliefs. So after World War II came the Cold War, and a lot of people thought Truce and Freddie were just too controversial to honor or celebrate. Eventually, Truce said her beliefs had changed. She wasn't a communist anymore. Meanwhile, in interviews, Freddie refused to answer questions about her political leanings. Neither one openly supported Marxism anymore, but they were still met with suspicion. However, Hani became a celebrity. It may have helped that nobody knew what her political beliefs were before she died. She never said anything to indicate she was a communist. So while Truce and Freddie stayed in obscurity, officials in the Netherlands named roads after Hani. Movies were made about her life story. It took decades before the sisters got any kind of recognition in their home country, and by and large, the international community didn't learn about them until after they died and their obituaries revealed everything that they'd done. Truce passed away in 2016, and Freddie followed in 2018. They both were 92 years old. And it's not too hard to see why the legacy they left behind was so complicated. Setting aside their personal communist leanings, Freddie and Truce's work was the sort of thing that you wouldn't usually celebrate. Most of the time, luring countless men to their deaths would be a bad thing. It would be an episode that we would talk about. But this case is the nature of war. People go to extremes to help their cause. And from the sound of it, Truce and Freddie had to spend years afterward coming to terms with what they'd done. Even Hani had symptoms that were consistent with PTSD before her execution. Either way, it's clear that they all paid a toll with their lives, their sense of safety, their mental health. The rest of us can only hope we'll never have to be put in a situation where we have to make such difficult life or death choices. And that was the story of Hani, Truce, and Freddie. It's definitely a corner that we haven't really explored on Into the Dark. War and two sides of it, and right and wrong, and when is it okay and when is it not? And honestly, it's not a black and white answer either. Like, there's so much gray to this, but I felt like Truce and Freddie and Hani's story needed to be told. And I hope that you found it interesting with the little history aspect. So thank you guys so much for listening. And I'll be back with another episode next week as we go further into the dark together. Goodbye.